Walter Cronkite had nearly finished the broadcast of the CBS Evening News on April 4, 1968, when a news bulletin from Memphis came in.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight.
In the hours that followed the news, social unrest swept across the country. It would be called the Holy Week Uprising. We're talking about this defining moment in American history here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jason Sokol is the Arthur K. Whitcomb Associate Professor of History at the University of New Hampshire. His new book is The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King, Jr. He's also the author of two critically acclaimed books on the history of the civil rights movement, All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics, From Boston to Brooklyn, and There Goes My Everything, White Southerners in the Age of Civil Rights, 1945 to 1975. Jason, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kate. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, your book picks up where a number of other books about Dr. King leave off, focusing on the reactions and the events of the days and months after April 4th. Why were you interested in exploring all of these threads, all of these snapshots going on around the country that take you in so many different directions?
Well, I thought it was a way to offer a new perspective on Martin Luther King. You know, as you say, there's so many wonderful books about King's life, but I hadn't fully understood myself what was the impact of this really dreadful moment, his assassination. So what I ended up finding was that, since King is such an exalted and revered hero right now, we tend to assume that his assassination must have been a moment of national tragedy, collective grief, but I actually found it was a moment of breaking apart, and that people's responses were quite diverse.
Breaking apart in what way? What were you seeing? Was it this division between white and black Americans? Was it a division between values, between economic classes? What were some of these threads?
Well, at this point in 1968, American society was already dividing along a lot of lines. I mean, the Vietnam War was really splitting the populace. And yeah, the racial divides were very significant and very real. Many whites were really started to participate in a backlash against the civil rights movement. They were frightened and scared of calls for black power. And then you had politicians like George Wallace and Richard Nixon who were playing into white anger. And I think one of the last people in the country who was still trying to bridge some of these divides was Martin Luther King, one of the last people who was trying to still unite whites and blacks. And he was also trying to talk to the different factions in the black freedom struggle. So I think once he was gone, then sort of that last hope for national unity was also gone.
It was like this missing piece.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, King, he really labored to speak to the young and disaffected African Americans, many of whom had participated in urban rioting. And even though King was so committed to nonviolence, he still wanted to reach out to these other kinds of people. And no one else, you know, in the civil rights movement or even in the nation was trying to really reach out and speak to the urban youth at the same time that they were also speaking to mainstream national political leaders. So I think King was really unique in that sense that he had sort of one foot in Washington in the strongholds of power and the other foot in the streets.
And willing to work with Washington. He'd also moved his focus a bit from civil rights in the Deep South to looking more in the North And at the time of his assassination, he was in Memphis to rally with the sanitation workers who were striking for higher wages and much better working conditions. He had been there just a few days earlier to lead a peaceful march to City Hall, but the march did not stay peaceful. What happened there?
Yeah, King, you know, these garbage workers in Memphis had gone on strike in February, and King came out to give a speech in mid-March, and he agreed to come back and lead a demonstration on March 28th. And he led this street protest, and then behind him, the crowd behind him got unruly and turned to violence. And King was whisked away from the march. And then what happened after this was he was roundly denounced and viciously criticized by many journalists and many political figures. And these were people who had already been criticizing him. And as you said, the reason was because King himself was becoming much more explicitly radical. He was attacking segregation in northern cities like Chicago, which angered white liberals, many of whom had previously supported his Southern crusades.
And he had moved to Chicago.
Right. He actually he took up residence in a slum in 1966, and he, you know, with the stated goal of ending slums, which is of course quite an ambitious goal. And then he also, you know, tried to take on basically the real estate industry and that whole cycle that had created all white neighborhoods and all black neighborhoods. And that really, you know, that was really threatening and challenging to a lot of white people in the North in the way that, say, his crusades for desegregation in the South hadn't really threatened them where they lived. And then 1967, King spoke out forcefully against the Vietnam War. And that further enraged a segment of white Americans. And then finally, he was waging this Poor People's Campaign in 1968, which helped to bring him to Memphis.
Why did King go back to Memphis? What was at stake for him there?
Right. Well, when this march that we were discussing, this march on March 28th, it devolved into violence. And then many leaders, you know, said, hey, this shows that King is not peaceful, that he's not nonviolent. It shows that he's really an agitator, a rabble rouser. So King's reputation here was really in question in a way that it hadn't been previously in his career. And also, the whole theory of nonviolence was sort of on the line. You know, it was King realized that, you know, this protest had devolved into violence and people were questioning whether he could even lead a peaceful march. So he felt at that point that he had to go back to Memphis and that he had to lead a peaceful march there, and that he had to keep assisting the garbage workers, both for their own cause and for his greater cause of sort of peace and nonviolence. So that's what brought him back to Memphis for a final visit when he landed there on April 3rd.
Talking with author Jason Sokol, the new book is The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. We can explore your legacy. What do you see of MLK legacy today? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jason, so much has been said and written about Dr. King's last speech given in Memphis on April 3rd, but it is worth listening to again as we talk about the ripple effects of his assassination.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and I've seen the promised land. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Jason, what do you hear in those words of this very famous last speech?
Well, it's of course, it's an incredible speech, and you know, we have the luxury of hearing it in retrospect and knowing what happened the following day, which is that he was assassinated. And in that light, it often seems that King was indeed anticipating his own death, which is, of course, amazing to think about. I mean, it has to be said that many times he sort of speculated and talked about his own death just because of the intensity of death threats that he so often got. So it wasn't necessarily unique for him to speak about that, but something about the feeling and the emotion inside Mason Temple that night. I mean, you can hear the crowd, and you can hear the dynamic between King and the audience there, where he's saying, you know, we as a people will get to the mountaintop, and they're urging him on to that mountaintop. And something about the feeling in that temple, I mean, so this is 1960, this was 1968.
Jason, we have to pause right there for a news update here on the Ideas Network. The night of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, 50 years ago today, President Lyndon B. Johnson addressed the nation.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
After Dr. King's death, President Johnson acknowledged the feelings of protesters. Lawmakers resolved to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which included the Fair Housing Act. The new book is The Heavens Might Crack. Jason Sokol stays with us here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You can join in with your questions, your remembrances at 800-642-1234. Were you involved in the civil rights movement of the 1960s? Are you active in social justice efforts now? What is MLK's legacy? What are your observations about how it's changed over time? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Jason, we just heard there that clip from President Johnson addressing the nation. He also addressed the nation the following day after the assassination. Tell us about what was happening inside the Oval Office and how President Johnson was also working with lawmakers, but also having a voice to keep Americans calm at this time, because it seems like there are two different forces going on.
Yeah, well, the relationship between King and Johnson was very complex, certainly by this point. The two men had worked very closely on civil rights legislation back in 1964 and then 65, but Johnson was enraged by King's anti-war stance, and by 68, the two men were no longer on speaking or on working terms. So Johnson's primary goal here after the King assassination was not necessarily to mourn the loss of King. His primary goal was to make sure that there wasn't rioting in the streets, because the summer of 1967 had brought the most devastating riots in American history. July of 67, Newark and Detroit erupted in great conflagration. So Johnson knew that there was the potential for urban uprisings in the wake of King's assassination, so he took to the airwaves to try to quell that. Of course, he wasn't effective, because there were certainly riots in dozens of cities.
And the riots had a profound impact on college campuses. One place you write about at Duke, in Durham, North Carolina, where students staged a strike advocating for the low-wage black workers on campus. Why was that an important story to tell as you explored the impact of King's death and the aftermath on college campuses?
Well, you know, part of the idea in the book was to find some unexpected stories or find new stories that people didn't know about how King's death impacted Americans. So I think a lot of people are aware of the urban riots, for instance. They're aware that there was a great funeral march for King. But there were instances of instances in which Americans didn't just break apart, but where they did come together, where, you know, you had interracial demonstrations and people working for social justice. So, for instance, at Duke, which had the reputation of a wealthy and conservative Southern school, you had about 1,500 students and faculty waged a silent vigil on the main quad of Duke, and their demands were that the workers there, cafeteria workers and workers like that, would be paid a fair wage and would get collective bargaining rights.
Let's bring in Lori now from Milwaukee. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I was 10 years old when Reverend King was killed, and I know I was at home, and I remember the turmoil, turning our lights out, making sure that we stayed in the dark, so you wouldn't be attacked by your own, because they were just burning everything and tearing everything up. But you also asked about what did you do or what are you doing as a civil rights activist or doing something to contribute to change. And I, in my personal lifestyle, I change people by being me and challenging them on some of the beliefs that they may or may not have. Amongst my ignorant white peers, workmates, and close family friends. An example of that is I had a friend who was having a conversation about Mexican food. And she said, well, we went and we had mole. And then she turns to me and says, well, you wouldn't know what that was. And you have to check people right where they are, that kind of a thing. Or the stereotype of, oh, we just don't go over there. We just never go over there. Where is over there? I live in Milwaukee. The reason Northridge died is because of perception. Terry Anderson killed Northridge when he murdered his wife there and attempted to blame it on a young black male by purchasing his cap and throwing it on the scene. That destroyed this area. From this point, that point on, it was a gradual decline. I don't know if it's going to ever come back. I'm praying God it does. But perception kills areas, kills communities, and kills people. People look at you as the other. We're not the other. We are now the majority. Learn to live with it. Talk, dialogue, and communicate with who you consider the other. Don't get that funny little acting, little twitch. I work with that every day. I'm not going to call her name, but it's like this woman is so affluent, has so much money, lives such a sheltered, beautiful life, and has the audacity to complain about some blinds. I'm like, baby girl, you don't know. And I just keep my mouth shut and I observe. When things get too much out of order, I come and I correct it. And that's
Lori, thank you. Yeah, Lori, thank you so much. And I want to bring Jason's observations about what happened in Milwaukee at this time. Jason, go ahead.
Oh, well, in the aftermath of King's killing, there were some great public gatherings and public demonstrations. And on April 8th, which was the Monday after King's assassination, Father James Grappi led the largest civil rights demonstration in Milwaukee history, where 15,000 people marched through downtown. And that was one of the larger marches in the wake of King's assassination.
You also dig into the hatred that, and it's really hard to remember that today, given the way Dr. King is generally viewed, that there was a lot of white people who reviled him, regarded him as a communist or a criminal. And so you dig into that and the way it emerged and eventually transformed following his death. Were you surprised by what you found as you were researching this for your book?
Oh, I was definitely struck by the depth of white hatred toward King, not only in his last years, but also after his death. I mean, there were some white people who rejoiced that King was dead. They thought King had it coming to him. They thought King had received his just desserts. And this wasn't just people in the South. It was all across the country. I read letters, people writing letters in Chicago and Michigan and the Bronx. And it wasn't generational either. There were also plenty of young white Americans who expressed this hatred toward King.
Let's bring in Keith now, joining us from Beaver Dam. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I had a moment that I was 10 years old when it happened. I heard it on the radio, and I asked my father, who in our area, you definitely didn't know anybody that was black. And to see somebody, you know, so it was like, it was easy to probably develop a prejudice against something maybe you didn't know. But anyway, I asked my dad, I says, when Martin Luther King died, I said, was he a good man? And he just paused for a second, and he said, yes, he was a good man. And that helped me look at situations that involve people of color or other things with a really good view. I didn't get that stain of hatred or racism that could have developed. And that was remarkable at the time, and I never forgot that.
Keith, thank you so much for bringing that story. Jason, what were your big takeaways from how African Americans reacted to Dr. King's death?
Well, you know, one of the prevailing narratives about King at the end of his life is that he was losing support even in the African American community. And that's because a lot of African Americans, particularly young African Americans, were turning to Black Power. I guess what I found is that the differences were a little bit overestimated, and that African Americans, regardless of their philosophy toward violence or nonviolence, they all felt the profound loss of King. It was almost like a death in the family. They might have disagreed with his methods a bit, but they still felt this deep and enduring connection with King. Those African Americans who were committed to Black Power felt that loss just as powerfully as African Americans who were right there with King in terms of nonviolence.
What did you find in the immediate aftermath in terms of African Americans? I mean, we just heard from Lori, who said, you know, turning her lights off and being still and not going out. However, we saw uprising as well across the country. So were reactions mixed, and especially as to perhaps where you lived?
Yeah, I think for African Americans who lived in the middle of big cities, it was not only an angry time, but a scary and frightful one. I mean, there was violence in many cities. There was also the National Guard to contend with. I mean, for instance, in Memphis, the Black community felt that, their leader had been slaughtered, and then they were treated as criminals because the National Guard came into Black neighborhoods and sort of forcibly repressed African Americans. So there was a sort of complex range of things going on for Black people to navigate, you know, the fear of rioting, the fear of the National Guard, this feeling of the loss of King, and then how to go on.
We're talking with Jason Sokol this hour. His book is The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you remember hearing about Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination when it happened? What was your reaction? What was the reaction of people around you? How did you feel about what happened around you? Were you involved in the civil rights movement of the 1960s? Are you active in social justice efforts now? What do you make of MLK's legacy? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jason, in the years before his death, whites and blacks openly questioned the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance for different reasons, but Dr. King was committed. Here he is during a speech at the University of Wisconsin in November of 1965, a few months after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, making his case for nonviolent protest.
The method of nonviolent resistance is effective in that it has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, It works on his conscience. It also makes it possible for the individual to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means.
How did Dr. King's assassination mark a turning point in how people viewed his doctrine of nonviolence?
Yeah, well, I mean, this was already a very contentious issue, especially in the African-American community, but I think for those people who gravitated toward more militant tactics, they thought that King's death had clinched their argument. People like Stokely Carmichael, they thought King's death showed that white America wasn't going to respond to peacefulness, that white America had to be challenged more directly. So, in fact, after King's death, one of the big developments was that King's death directly led to the national growth of the Black Panther Party. Before King's death, the Panthers were, of course, prominent and well-known and famous, but they only had actual local chapters in California. After King's death, Black Panther chapters formed all over the country.
And what impact did you see those chapters having? Did they get traction right away? Did they get, you know, what was the impact there?
Yeah, I think many of them did get traction. I mean, many African Americans decided, you know, that they wanted to join in social justice, and that the Panthers were offering a kind of radical and militant alternative that they thought, you know, spoke to them in this moment of hatefulness and violence. And you know, the Panthers offered not only armed self-defense, but they also did a lot of things for urban communities, where they offered breakfast programs and medical clinics. So the Panthers weren't just this sort of violent militant movement. They were also about mobilizing Black people in the cities across America.
And what is the reaction of other movements, Congress on Racial Equality, SNCC? What are these movements doing at this time of MLK's death?
Well, by this time of 68, both CORE and SNCC had both embraced more militant and violent alternatives. I mean, SNCC had expelled white people by this time and had sort of sworn off their old nonviolent ethos. So I think SNCC and CORE were doing similar things that the Black Panthers were doing at this time, actually. But people who used to be in the SNCC of old, like John Lewis, for instance, John Lewis didn't see many places for himself in this new militant Black freedom struggle. So what John Lewis did was he volunteered in Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign after King's assassination.
We're analyzing the impact of Dr. King's death on the 50th anniversary of his assassination here on The Morning Show. The book is The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason Sokol weaves together archival material. He's weaving together oral histories and interviews, newspaper reactions on the local and national level to look at Dr. King's legacy through a wide variety of lenses around the assassination. Your remembrances, your questions are welcome. 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the assassination? What was the reaction of people around you? How did you feel about what was happening around you? And what is Dr. King's legacy today? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update here on the Ideas Network. The idea for a national holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was first proposed just 4 days after his assassination 50 years ago today. But it took a long and winding path through partisan politics before becoming law in November of 1983. Here's how ABC News White House correspondent Sam Donaldson reported on it.
The White House staged an impressive ceremony today, the president and Dr. King's widow walking into the Rose Garden together in an effort to spruce up Mr. Reagan's tattered civil rights image. The president signed the bill, which he had so strongly opposed, making Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday.
In October of 1983, the Senate passed the holiday legislation by a wide margin. 18 Republicans voted against the holiday, as did 4 Democrats. The bill moved to President Reagan's desk. We're talking about the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. on the 50th anniversary of his death. University of New Hampshire historian Jason Sokol stays with us. His new book is The Heavens Might Crack, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your remembrances? What do you see as MLK's legacy today? Is the legacy clear? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Troy now, who is waiting in Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Hello, good morning. I just want to say, make a point here that I noticed that this day and age, that Caucasians have a tendency to kind of whitewash Dr. King with a lot of his quotes. I noticed that it kind of reminds me of like how pastors and churches will kind of pick and choose scriptures that fits their agenda. I noticed they do that a lot with a lot of Dr. King's quotes, and examples of that would be I noticed that like the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of people will say, well, they believe in Dr. King, but then they won't support Black Lives Matter because they say it's too extreme. And I think those are contradictory if you look at the historical context in which King was doing things. He would have been considered an obstructionist, and he would have been, I think, the Black Lives Matter movement is equivalent to the kinds of things that he was doing. And I just want to make another point. I grew up in, my parents were, they actually marched in that across that bridge in Milwaukee. And a lot of things that, you know, aren't told is my parents, I'm Caucasian, and my parents told me on the other side of that bridge were a lot of white people with bats, spitting on blacks. It was real ugly, you know? So I just want to point that out.
Troy, thank you so much for calling in with your reflections. Jason, you write that Dr. King's death marked the beginning of a long process of sanitizing his legacy. Can you explore that for us and who ultimately won there?
Yeah, you know, the last chapter of my book is called From Outlaw to Saint, and it tracks how King went from being this polarizing, controversial figure at the time of his death to this revered all-American hero. And I think a lot of what Troy said is exactly right. I think, you know, once King was dead, he could no longer speak and weigh in himself. And so Americans got to shape his legacy in the way that they wanted, basically. And I think a lot of white Americans latched on to one part of King's legacy, which was his call for colorblindness, and they would highlight, you know, the one famous quote in the I Have a Dream speech where King said he longed for the day when his children would be judged not by the color of skin, but by the content of their character. You know, King didn't reprise that quote all that much in his career. I think probably more representative for King was where in the same speech he talked about the unspeakable horrors of police brutality and the whirlwinds of revolt that would shake the nation if justice didn't come. And those kinds of things are indeed the kinds of things that the Black Lives Matter movement would be saying. So I think a lot of white Americans chose to grasp onto the more comfortable part of King's message, the colorblind part, and to simply discard the more threatening and challenging parts of his message.
Before we get into more of the contemporary discussions, though, let's hear how Robert F. Kennedy broke the news to a crowd in Indianapolis where he had been scheduled to campaign.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort.
So the clip there from Senator Robert F. Kennedy, how did Dr. King's assassination play into the 1968 presidential campaign? And what was Kennedy's influence there?
Yeah, that's a really amazing speech because the mayor of Indianapolis, who was Richard Lugar, didn't want Kennedy to go and make the speech in a black neighborhood. He thought he thought that there would be violence at the speech. Anyway, Kennedy went to the rally and he spoke extemporaneously. He even talked about his own brother's death for the first time in public. And then to your question, you know, how did the King assassination shape the 1968 presidential campaign? Well, up until the King assassination, the main issue was the Vietnam War. And so Eugene McCarthy was the anti-war candidate. And March 31st, LBJ declared he was not going to run for re-election. That's because he had lost so much support because of the war issue. And Bobby Kennedy was anti-war, and he threw his hat into the ring. And then after the King assassination, the issue was not only the war, but also the question of who was going to be able to heal the racial divide. And so Robert Kennedy was able to speak to that issue in a way that a lot of other candidates weren't. And that's why so many people placed their hopes in Kennedy after King's death, and why it was so shattering when Kennedy himself was murdered on June 4th.
So what impact did Dr. King's assassination have on the debates that were raging over legislation like gun control and fair housing in the months after his death?
Yeah, well, the Fair Housing Act, which was part of the Civil Rights Act of 1968, had already made it through the Senate after a long process of filibustering. And so the question was really just, the question was whether the House would pass it and how quickly. And I think King's death expedited and accelerated that process, and the House of Representatives indeed passed the bill quickly, and then Johnson signed it. But less well known is the impact of King's assassination on gun control, where 2 days after King's death, the Senate Judiciary Committee finally moved a gun control bill to the Senate floor. And then retailers, businesses responded by some of them by banning guns and ammunition, which is a sort of similar response we're seeing now. And then with Kennedy's assassination in June, the impetus for gun control even grew stronger.
Well, as we came back in, we heard the clip of ABC News' Sam Donaldson basically setting the scene for us of the Rose Garden ceremony of President Reagan making it a national holiday. You explore the wrangling over a national King holiday in quite a bit of detail. Why is it important to tell that story?
Well, because you know, Reagan was an opponent of the holiday. Reagan was against the King holiday, and it's important to show just how long and hard many conservatives really opposed Martin Luther King's legacy. And Reagan only embraced it when that holiday passed the Senate and the House by these large margins. So I think this was really a bruising and contested process for King to become enshrined as a national hero. And that process played out also in all 50 states, which all had to decide whether they were going to have King holidays of their own.
And it was Representative John Conyers of Michigan who first proposed the idea 4 days after King's assassination in 1968. To think that it didn't actually get signed into law until 1983, that's a long time. What were some of the issues going on there?
Yeah, and Conyers proposed the holiday legislation once a year, every year, basically, for the next decade, and each time it was rejected by the House. I think, a lot of Republicans thought that King wasn't really deserving of a national holiday. You know, he still was seen as a confrontational, challenging leader up until the 80s. And, you know, they also had some concerns, they said, about the holiday costing a lot or about how the holiday shouldn't be given to a private citizen. And then finally, King's supporters were able to project this image of King as sort of somebody who spoke to everyone. And this all-encompassing version of King finally carried the day.
How does Dr. King's political philosophy resonate today in the context of how you explored his death and exploring all of these different threads? Where are some of the through lines that you see shaping what we're talking about today?
Well, I think you know, one of the things to which King was most committed was nonviolent civil disobedience. So he said, you know, whenever and wherever there was injustice, it was the obligation of individuals to protest and to get in the streets and to tie up traffic and to paralyze cities. And King did that day after day, month after month, year after year. So I think we're currently having a debate in our country about protest. I mean, there's a lot of white people who think that athletes shouldn't kneel silently on a football field. I think King did a lot more than that. There's a lot of people who think that protesters shouldn't tie up traffic in Sacramento. And King did a lot more than that. So I think it's worth remembering that if we're going to embrace King, we have to also embrace these modern day protesters.
And some of these modern day issues that still are very much alive today: poverty, economic disparity, housing inequality, and of course, deep divisions between Black and white Americans.
Yeah, I think it can't be said enough that King died fighting for garbage workers, fighting for these men who had meager wages and no benefits. And so I think, you know, the economic inequality has only deepened in our own time. And it's also worth remembering that at the time of his death, King was urging the federal government to enact a guaranteed annual income for every American, a guaranteed job for every American. And so, you know, those kinds of things he thought were needed in order to remedy this great economic inequality. And so, you know, in a way, King was to the left of almost everyone on the national scene today.
Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Jason Sokol is the author of the new book, The Heavens Might Crack: The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Boltina and executive producer Michelle Johnson. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.